From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour was made when a 22-year-old musician was walking out of a concert hall in Chicago. Four men rushed him and shoved him into a car. They were carrying guns. They took him to a place called the Hawthorne Inn, wondering if he was about to be murdered or if he would be held for ransom. He didn't know what would happen next. And the bizarre answer was neither. The inn was owned by Al Capone. The year was 1926, and the musician was Thomas Fats Waller. Capone was enjoying a birthday party, and Waller was the surprise guest and performer, held and forced to perform at gunpoint. The party lasted for days, and Waller eventually was released, very drunk, very tired, and very popular with Capone and his friends. Now, exactly how much of that story is true has been up for debate, depending on the source you read, but here's what I can tell you. One of my favorite music historians sent me down a Fats Waller rabbit hole when I encountered the subject of his new book. You've heard Michael Lasser on WXXI for years, the host of Fascinating Rhythm and an author who has chronicled the story of American music, and his new book expands the lens. Fats Waller is just one part of it. What I find so compelling is that Lasser seems innately able to answer this question. What makes a song more than just a song? What makes a song a part of the American cultural fabric? When does music take on the ability to offer a window into a country's soul? The music that Lasser writes about in his newest book is not all about politics or overt commentary. Often it's subtle. And if we were looking for songs today that reflect the spirit of the country, I wonder what the historians of the future would say. What are historians going to point to 50 years from now? Well, this is what Michael Lasser does. He's looking at the first half of the 20th century in his book. Consider that story about Fats Waller. Consider that Fats Waller also pushed through racist housing barriers to help lead a revolution of artists living in Queens. The man went through a lot in his short life. And yet the songs he wrote reflect an optimism, a verve. Songs like "This Joint is Jumpin'," but what was it really about? What does that tell us about a person or a time? The new book is called City Songs in American Life, 1900 to 1950, and the man who ain't misbehaving is Michael Lasser. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're always mildly misbehaving.
I'm going to say, if I'm going to have to behave, I should just put my hat on.
I know you. This is going to be hard for you. This is going to be very hard for you. I was fixated on the Fats Waller story because that's not a name I knew much about.
Really?
And not only that, but you know, some of the music I might know from afar, not all that intimately. And the more I read about him, the more he might even be connected to songs he doesn't even get credit for. What a fascinating career.
Well, he did, in fact, he was, as you suggested, he was an alcoholic. And he was a man who lived for the present moment. What's interesting is he collaborated with a great lyricist named Andy Razaf, who also African-American, who was, first of all, meticulous in himself, as opposed to Waller, who was all over the place, weighed 300 pounds for starts. And Razaf was always thinking about the future, always meticulous not only in his personal habits, but in his intellectual manner. And they were, if opposites attract, it was the case study. I mean, they really were quite different. But Waller would go into a publisher, music publisher, broke, and say, "Hey, I'll write you a song for $2.50. This is in the 20s. For $2.50, and he'd sit down at the piano and he'd toss something off. The guy'd give him $2.50, and so he could buy a bottle and a hamburger and get through another day. His talent was prodigious. He was a great composer. He was a great performer of his and other songs as well.
The Al Capone story, true or false?
I don't know, but it's because who's gonna disagree with Al Capone? But it's popular. You know how there are certain fields that take on a certain something. Baseball players historically have extraordinary names. You know, football players are named John Smith, but baseball players are named Vinegar Bend Mizell.
Yes.
They're just great names in baseball. There are some elsewhere, but baseball has great names.
Yeah.
Popular music historically has great stories. And some of them are true. A lot of them are true, but it's hard always to know exactly
where the line of truth is. Well, Michael Lasser, we'll get back to Fats Waller coming up, who died, by the way, at the age of just 41 years old. Did not live a long life. Might have been 39. I'm trying to do the math here.
I think he was 39.
39 years old.
Drank himself to death.
1904 birth, 1943 died. And we've got a clip of him that you'll hear later this hour from just a few months before he passed away. Before we get back there, though, what I want to ask is why you wrote the book and what the overarching theme here is. Because in my view, what you have done so well is you write the stories of American music, the American songbook, and you connect them to what the culture was doing and how the culture was changing. Why did you want to write this book?
I've played I don't know how many thousands of songs since I've been doing this. I'll bet it's close to 20,000 songs, maybe more, maybe 25,000 since I've been doing the radio show. And you begin to see certain things. Every show is for those listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, my show is very formatted. Every show has a theme and every song fits the theme for 1 hour a week. And as I did this over the years, I began to see not only that New York City is one of the great subjects of American song. It is. We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten Island too. Broadway melody, Broadway rhythm. There are hundreds and hundreds of songs about New York City. Penthouse Serenade, Take Me Back to Manhattan. New York, New York, twice. There are two songs called New York, New York. I began to see that it was more than just subject matter, that it was a way of looking at the world. It was a way of using language. It was a stance, not in the sense of phony, but a sense of position, of how you looked out at the world. There was a sensibility, that's the word I came to eventually, that was urban. Especially in New York, because that's where the music business was for so many years. Tin Pan Alley was there, Broadway was there, Harlem was there. And I began to see that everything else came from that. Even if the words New York never appeared, even if there was nothing about a city in the song, it was a way of looking at the world. Want an example?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Rodgers and Hart. Before Richard Rodgers wrote with Oscar Hammerstein, he wrote with Lorenz Hart in the 20s, 30s, into the early 40s, and then Oklahoma with Hammerstein. And Hart died. And in 1925, they wrote a song called Manhattan for a Broadway show. It was their first big break. The next year, they wrote a song called Mountain Greenery for another show. It's an urban song. It's about a newlywed couple settling in the country. But if you listen to the song, they're from the city and they're moving to the country. And Hart writes this. And Hart loved to play with language. And that kind of language play is that reliance on wit to create emotion is very much an urban thing, I think, rather than simply professing emotion. There's an ambiguity, there's even a skepticism, there's a room for the bittersweet, that kind of complexity, I think, is urban in nature. I'll say it fast and then I'll back up. Beans could get no keener reception in a beanery, bless our mountain greenery home. But here's the way he does it. The play with language is wonderful. First, do you know what a beanery is?
B-E-A-N-E-R-Y. I'm in a place where they can beans?
No. In the 1920s, it was a lunch wagon. An early diner, was because they serve beans, was a beanery. Slang.
Okay.
Beans could get no keenery. Reception in a beanery. If I said rhyme beanery, you'd go crazy. Well, beans could get no keenery. Reception in a beanery. Bless our mountain greenery home. So he brings this urban sensibility to bless what they're making in the country. It's an urban song about living in the country.
There's almost an Ogden Nash lyrical flow to it that I really like about that.
Yeah, yeah.
When do you know, Michael, though, that a song is worthy of being in one of your books, that a song is telling us something beyond just being a nice tune?
I think there are two lines to answer it. One is that most songs virtually disappear before they appear.
Mm-hmm.
A few get noticed and disappear. A few get play. A few become, and each few is smaller, obviously. We're narrowing. Become hit songs, regardless of how you measure it. Most streamings, fine. Most LPs sold at one time, whatever it is. Most plays on the radio by a disc jockey, regardless of the measurement at that moment, it becomes a hit, which means it lasts 6 to 8 weeks, and then it disappears. But there's a very few of those hits that survive into the next generation, and White Christmas is Over the Rainbow. They're called standards.
What's the story of Over the Rainbow?
When Harold Arlen, composer, and E.Y. Harburg, lyricist, were writing the score to Wizard of Oz, they got all done. If I only had a brain, we're off to see the wizard, they were done. And then one of them turned to the other and said, "Oh my God, we never wrote a song for Judy."
For Judy Garland.
Judy Garland. Now, Judy Garland was 18 years old playing a 12-year-old. They had to bind her breasts to make her look like a little girl, and yet she was a young woman. And so they had to write a song that would suit that woman's voice and yet be something a 12-year-old child might sing. And typically the music came first, so Arlen wrote a melody, and then Harburg came in to hear it, and Arlen had a rather flamboyant way of playing, lots of arpeggios, and he played the song. And Harburg looked at him and said, "Harold, I can't write anything to that." And he played it again, and he did, and he couldn't hear what he could write to. And the two men were upset. They were professionals. They were friends. They weren't angry, but they were upset by their frustration. And so they agreed that they would go home and come back the next day. And when Harburg got home, he called his old friend, Ira Gershwin. Gershwin had gotten Harburg into the lyric writing business, and he explained the problem. "Would you come with me?" So Gershwin went with him, and Arlen played it. And Gershwin had the same problem. He couldn't hear the melody in it. And he got a brainstorm. He said, "Harold, play the melody with one finger." And Arlen did, and Harburg said, "Oh, that I can write to." And he wrote the song. The studio bosses cut it 3 times because it made the show too long. And finally, a young assistant producer named Arthur Freed took Harburg and Arlen with him into Louis B. Mayer's office of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and said, "You've got to put the song in." And Mayer said, "Oh, all right, let the boys have their little song." What Over the Rainbow is, remember I was talking about ambiguity a couple of minutes ago? It's a melancholy song about hope. It's not a song about hopelessness. It's a song about hope. If this and this and this, then why can't I? The implication is that it will come. It isn't here yet, but it's melancholy in the moment. And so it's that rarity of rarities. We have melancholy songs. We have hopeful, happy songs. But this is a melancholy song about hope. And that's part
of
its power.
Hope and despair mixed together.
And it's part of its power.
What a great story. If it was not included, if Mayer didn't...
It would have been on the cutting
acquiesce.
Room floor. It would have been on the cutting room floor.
And we wouldn't be talking about
right.
it today.
We'd never have heard of it.
What a great story. Michael Lasser telling some of the stories from his new book that is available now. The book is called City Songs in American Life, 1900 to 1950. Every era needs a Michael Lasser to tell the stories of how the music told the stories of a culture, told the stories of what was changing. And I always appreciate the visits here. The book, by the way, is available. Where do you want people to get the book?
You can get it for reduced price from Amazon, or you can email me through the station if you would like an inscribed copy, and we'll trade a few emails so I know what you want me to write in it, and then you send me a check, and I inscribe it and send you the book.
Author, this is the most organic. Anyone who's ever written a book knows the most organic way to try to make money in American life is to be an author. I mean, just carrying books out of the trunk, you know, just it's amazing. Just all the roadshow events. And he does have a series of events. Really, in the fall, you've got things coming up here as we move towards September, October, yeah?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll be putting the book in the basket with my jams and jellies and going door to door. I may come to your neighborhood. but, yeah, I'm going to be doing some what they call author's talks in the fall. I'm going here and elsewhere. I'm going to be doing one at the Nazareth College Library in October. I wish I brought the list with me, Evan. I'm sorry I didn't. I'm going to be doing, I work with a couple of singers too, Cindy Miller and Alan Jones, and we're going to be doing a program of city songs as part of the JCC Book Fest in November. It's Jewish interest books, but the programs are and the authors are available to anybody who wants to come.
So you're already filling up your calendar. Let's take a couple of phone calls from listeners who want to win and what they're hearing already. First is Willa in Rochester. Go ahead, Willa.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When you introduced your show as, music that becomes anthem or enduring, the first thought song that came to my mind was Lee Greenwood's I'm Proud to Be an American. And the reason that one came up is, to my mind, was that, it came out about the same time as the first Gulf War. And it became like the anthem for every military deployment, regardless of the branch of service. You know, the Army has their anthem and the Marines have theirs, but this song crossed all of the branches of the military. And it endured for a decade at least, from the first Gulf War to the second.
That's a great point. Willa, thank you for that. And, Michael, that song comes a little later than what a lot of your focus is.
But
it's a great point.
The point is it's a very good example with an except. When I talk about a standard, one of the ways you define a standard, that is that it's a song that lasts at least, at the very minimum, more than one generation. It's the kind of song that grandparents, parents, and kids can stand around a piano.
You don't think Greenwood's song is on that?
It may very well be. It's certainly the kind of song.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It needs a little gray in its beard.
Well, I remember the weekend of 9/11, 2001, there was a big family reunion that I was set to attend down on Chautauqua Lake. And my uncle, who had served and had recently retired from the New York State Legislature, a long-serving Democrat, has some of his best friends are Republicans, has served with people on all parts of American life, and served in the Vietnam War and ended up writing a book about it. He said he drove back from California, because all the planes were grounded, all the way to Jamestown, New York, playing that Lee Greenwood song the whole way.
Yeah, I get it.
And he said most of the time that song annoyed me. It seemed a little sicky, sweet, patriotic.
Schmaltzy.
He said, but in those moments, he said, when I was desperate for unity, left, right, no matter your background, no matter your age, he said that was the song that did it for me. So who knows, Willa?
Can I give you another title?
Yeah.
God Bless America. Written in 1917, published in 1938, and yet on 9/11... And thereafter, we didn't turn to the Star Spangled Banner. We didn't even turn to America the Beautiful, which is, a greater song than God Bless America. But that simplicity and directness, it became America's song. And to this day still is. They sing it at baseball games. So that's a standard.
The Yankees started doing that with the seventh inning stretch.
And a lot of baseball teams do it now.
Yeah. Andrew in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Michael, love your show.
Thank you.
Just love everything about you. You have a great radio voice, too, don't you think, Evan?
Michael is in the category for me, which is the highest compliment I could give, which is if I could pour your voice into a bottle, I could spread it on pancakes.
It really. You must have been told that before, Mr. Lance.
I've been told it, but you know, I don't get credit for having a voice. God gets the credit for the voice.
There you go. I like that.
God gets the credit for the talent. You get the credit for what you do with it.
There you go. I like that. Hey, what do you think about all those people that seem to be throwing songs and people out that are not politically correct? Is that a good thing to get into?
It's okay with me. I'm troubled by it. I think if you measured my politics... And I'm not going to get into those in any detail because they're nobody's business.
Yeah.
But you would find that I'm more in agreement with those people than disagreement. But I think the idea of censorship is odious and repugnant. When I was a young man, censorship came from the right. Now it comes from the left. It's no less odious.
I got a question. In the movies, there used to be really racy films. And then I think in the mid-30s, there was a censorship board.
32, there was a... movies were afraid, the movie studios were afraid that Congress was going to pass some laws restricting them. So they began to police themselves in ways that would make conservative congressmen, there were very few, in fact, there may not have been any congresswomen in those years, to make conservative congressmen relax.
So my question is was there also a corresponding phenomena in the music industry?
There was no formal board with power. But stations policed themselves and networks policed themselves because, for the same basic reason, they did not want to run afoul of the law.
I love the racy stuff that was written and that you play. It's absolutely hilarious to listen to. I love some of the stuff.
Listen, sex has always been in songs.
What?
Yes, I. Oh. Yeah, gambling? Are you telling me there's gambling going on in here?
Michael Lasser.
It's always been in songs, but it was subtle. It was indirect. It was playful.
It's just a joy to listen to some of that stuff, and I'm so glad you play it.
Well, they're good songs.
Yeah.
I
hope you don't get censored.
No one here has ever... I'll be on the air 40 years next year, and no one at XXI has ever tried to censor me. That's why I'm still here, because I'd walk.
Michael Lasser is our guest, the host of Fascinating Rhythm that you know so well, and his newest book is called City Songs in American Life, 1900 to 1950, and we're talking about what made some of these songs so emblematic of a time of perhaps change, growth, the way New York City in particular, but the American city was becoming the epicenter of our cultural fabric. And we've got more songs to share with you in our second half hour. Let's get our only break, and we're going to come back. Should we listen to some music?
Sure. What do you want to listen to?
I've got a few.
Put one on.
We've got a few. Let's go to break. We're going to come back with Michael Lasser and enjoy many more stories here about American songs, in particular, city songs in American life. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Monroe County Executive Cheryl Donolfo sits down with us in studio for the hour. The county executive is running for re-election, and on this program, you have already heard her Democratic opponent, Adam Bello, the county clerk. Now it's our chance to sit down with the county executive to talk about her record, her plans for a next term, why she wants to be re-elected. Cheryl Donolfo, Tuesday on Connections.
That tells you if a party is 10 times more than dance is bumping. This is fun, it's more than hot. In fact, the joint is jumping.
Check your weapons at the door. Be sure to pay your quarter.
Burn your leather around the floor. Grab anybody's daughter.
Woo! The roof is rocking. The neighbor's knocking.
We're all bums when the wagon comes. I mean, this joint is jumping.
Let it be.
So, Michael Lasser, that's This Joint is Jumpin'.
That is a song about a Harlem rent party from the Great Depression.
A Harlem rent party from the Great Depression.
From the Great Depression. That is, every song is a creature of its own time. Every novel is a creature of its own time. Everything is a creature of its own time. Some speak to us, a few. Hamlet is a creature of Elizabethan England. But it continued to speak to us for another 400 years, and it's still speaking. You go up to the Stratford Festival, you can see people, you'll see 2,000 people in a theater watching Hamlet. It's still alive. Most things don't. Most things just date and disappear. The Harlem Rent Party is part of the Harlem Renaissance. We're celebrating, just beginning now, the 100th anniversary of the Harlem Renaissance. When things got bad, people needed to make their rent, poor people. And poor African Americans came up with an ingenious solution. They would take little cards and write John Smith, rent party, and the address and the date. And when you got there, you would put anything, depending on what they were charging, from a nickel to a half a buck in a hat. And you could go in, and there would be a piano player for dancing. There'd be food. There'd be bootleg hooch in the bathtub. It would go all night, and people just came and went. And by the end of the night, you'd probably have your rent for the next month. The references, the piano was playing, check your weapons at the door. Grab anybody's daughter and start dancing. There was probably casual sex going on in the bedroom. It was a place to get the latest news from the neighborhood. At the end, you would expect the wagons to come. There was often in these songs about rent parties a reference to wagons, paddy wagons, because the neighbors would call the police because there was so much noise, and they'd come and arrest people. And so it's the story of one rent party that's emblematic of rent parties.
It is such an electric, upbeat song.
Yeah, well, they're having a good time.
About something that was created innovatively, but out of a sort of a desperate situation.
You got it. There's another song called Raising the Rent by Harold Arlen and Ted Keeler, which comes at it that way. A woman is struggling to figure out how she's going to make the rent. And she decides, she doesn't want to leave this apartment, doesn't want to leave the neighborhood, but she decides she has to and she'll be okay. And that's how it ends.
Reading about Fats Waller, who wrote The Joint is Jumpin', right?
Yeah. He wrote the music.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it when people say it's a Gershwin song, because Gershwin never wrote a single word. He only wrote notes. Got to get the lyricist.
Well, he should get some credit for that.
Yeah, but not all the credit.
Okay.
Not a Gershwin song. It's a song by Gershwin and Gershwin. This is by Waller and Razaf.
Okay, so there you go. And Fats Waller, another interesting part of his own biography was in 1938, he was one of the first African Americans to purchase a home in the Addisley Park section of Queens, a New York City community with racially restrictive covenants at the time. And after his purchase, litigation in the New York State courts, many prosperous African Americans followed. Lena Horne, Ella Fitzgerald, Milt Hinton, following Fats Waller at a time when, I mean, look, this is not a perfect country today, but boy, the rules were very different. That is a daring and bold thing to do.
It was. It was. And it would not, I don't know what was in Fats Waller's mind, obviously. I wasn't even born yet. Well, 38 I was born. but based on what I know about Waller, I don't think he would have seen himself as an activist, as a reformer, as a protester. I think it's more likely that Waller liked the house and just wasn't going to let anybody.
And just said, yeah, I want this house.
Yeah, and just wasn't going to let anybody tell him. Wasn't going to let anybody tell him where he could live.
Racist rules are not going to stop me from buying here.
And he just bought the house because that's where he wanted to be.
It's a great story. I hope you're enjoying these stories from Michael Lasser. Anna is. Anna says, in Rochester, Anna writes, I love Michael Lasser. I just love him every Saturday morning at 11, listen to his radio show, and because I'm of a certain age that begins with an 8, I sing at the top of my lungs because I know all the words.
Good for her. See?
That's from Anna. So that was This Joint is Jumpin'. I grabbed a little clip of a song called Ain't Misbehavin'. And before we listen to Ain't Misbehavin', this is a Fats Waller performance of a Fats Waller lyrical song.
Fats Waller and Andy Razav in 1929.
And you need no more evidence that Ain't Misbehavin' has lasted than you see musicals bearing its name and the stories of Fats Waller. I mean, why has this song been so popular?
It's a great song. Public taste makes its decisions spontaneously, person by person by person. It was in a hit show, and it turned out that it had legs. And I think what's most interesting about it is that it's a pledge of fidelity, Ain't Misbehavin', by someone who can't wait to misbehave.
Should we listen? Let's listen.
To talk with all by myself, no one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Misbehaving, saving my love for you.
There's one wonderful thing he does in there. He says, saving my love for you and you and you and you.
I didn't catch that the first time.
Yeah, he makes it into a little joke. Yeah.
Michael Lasser, get your mind out of the gutter. I'm sure Fats Waller was just filling the dead air time of the song.
Listen, he was... He was not the noblest of humans. He was a guy who lived a life. I think there's no question that the alcoholism was deepened by racism. Mm. He was exploited. He never was able to have a settled life. I mean, he married, he had kids. In fact, one day in school, his son, when he was a little boy, they were having show and tell, and they were going around the room, and the teacher asked them what their daddies did. And when they got to young Master Waller, he said, my daddy drinks gin.
Wow.
Which is both funny and sad.
And very sad.
And pathetic in its way.
Mm. Michael Lasser, our guest, he's the host of Fascinating Rhythm, and his new book is called City Songs and American Life, 1900 to 1950. Got one more clip to play from the many songs referenced in Michael's new book that is available now. And the song is called On the Sunny Side of the Street. Tell me about it.
It was written by Jimmy McHugh and Dorothy Fields near the beginning of the Depression. The Depression had struck, so it's a Depression song. It's not only an urban sensibility, it's also a Depression sensibility. It's also an upbeat song. It borders on being a Pollyanna song in its optimism. And if you don't mind, let's listen, and then I'll make a distinction between Pollyanna songs from the 20s and Pollyanna songs from the 30s to show you how the sensibility shifts. Did I say the names of the songwriters?
Yes.
Okay. Composer Jimmy McHugh, lyricist Dorothy Fields. Dorothy Fields is worth talking about, too, if we have time.
This man is an encyclopedia. Let's listen to On the Sunny Side of the Street.
Oh,
grab your coat and snatch your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with the blues on parade. No longer afraid, the rover crossed over. If I never had a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. The gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street.
That performance gets me angry.
That is not what I expected to hear from Michael Lasser. Yeah,
well, to his great credit, Sinatra would always mention the name of the lyricist when he performed. He also often mentioned the name of the arranger. That's to his credit. So he'd mention the name of the lyricist, which very few performers do. And then he changed the lyric. And in changing the lyric, he would diminish it. Grab your coat and get your hat. What's going on in that line? Well, the A sound in grab gets picked up in the A sound in hat. That's the kind of thing lyricists think about. Sound. Grab and get. Remember you learned
grab
about
and
that?
Hat, yeah.
Grab and get. Alliteration. Grab your coat and get your hat. Okay. Grab and get. Grab and snatch undoes it. He weakens the lyric in order to show off. It's cheap. Gets me. I know. Look, we're all passionate about odd things. That's one.
Did you ever get a chance to tell Frank that?
No, but if Dorothy Fields, who was one of our great lyricists, wanted to write Snatch, she would have. No. So shut up and sing it, Frank.
The point you're making is that the precision matters.
Oh, absolutely.
Every detail matters here.
These people thought of the lyricists thought of themselves as masters of craft.
Setting aside the Sinatra performance
the
self-aggrandizing Frank Sinatra performance, the song is quite a...
It's a great song. It's a great
sanguine,
song.
Sanguine, optimistic view of
grab
life.
Grab your coat.
But maybe not merited by the circumstances of the time.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. That is, happiness is just ahead of you somewhere. The Pollyanna songs about during the 20s, Pollyanna songs are songs that are hopelessly optimistic.
What does the term Pollyanna come from?
It comes from a novel called Pollyanna by a woman named Eleanor Whittier. I think that's the name. I'm not sure.
Of course you would know this.
From the teens, I believe, 1913 or 15. And Pollyanna is a kid who is always optimistic, and because she is, everything always works out. And it became her name, Pollyanna. Pollyanna
Eleanor
Whittaker.
Porter.
Eleanor Porter and Pollyanna Whittaker is the name of the character. Thank you. And her name became synonymous with a kind of mindless optimism.
Yeah, like a naivete.
Yeah, yeah. And in the 20s, that optimism was right in the palm of your hand. But in the 30s, you were going to have to wait for it.
And this song came out when?
30.
Okay.
And so there's a sense of happiness delayed, fulfillment deferred. It'll come. It's a Pollyanna song. It promises you that the clouds will blow over and sunshine will come. Just not quite this minute, as opposed to the 20s, here it is.
You also wanted to tell the story of a song called Love Is Here to Stay.
Oh, my God.
Tell me the story.
Yeah. Last song by George and Ira before George died.
The Gershwins he's talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes. And
for people like me who might not have known.
And Ira finished this. It wasn't quite done. Ira got a little help from a friend and composer named Vernon Duke. And it's often said that the song is Ira's love song to his brother. They were extraordinarily close. Most lyricists, the composer writes the melody, he gives it to the lyricist who writes the words, and they bring it together. George and Ira wrote sitting next to one another at the piano. They were interwoven. You're never quite sure where one ends and the other begins, although George is mainly doing the music and Ira mainly doing the words. And the lyric is quite extraordinary. If you want to talk about the way in which songs are cultural artifacts of their time, and every song is, they're all love songs. But a love song from 1910 is not going to talk about love the way a love song is going to talk about it now. We think differently about it. We behave differently. The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend the world and all its capers and how this all will end. And what's going on there is you've got a mix of two things that aren't supposed to go together. They're at the heart of the urban sensibility, I think. Sentiment and wit. Sentiment opens you to emotion. It engages you. It brings you close to something. Wit requires that you step back and look with clear eyes and say, oh my God, the emperor's naked. Sentiment, if you feel it deeply enough, doesn't care because it has the feeling. Capers opens the song to wit. The world is coming apart. This is the late 30s. The world is getting ready to explode into a war. Things, terrible things are happening in Europe. Hitler's come to power. The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend. This is a grown-up. This is not an adolescent speaking in that song. The world and all its capers and how this all will end. He talks about things like motion pictures and the radio, 1930s, as passing fancies. But in time, the Rockies may crumble, little hyperbole. Gibraltar may tumble, and then this wonderful understatement, they're only made of clay. Notice how the wit is carrying us through the emotion, and then it makes way, it makes it possible for the fullness of the sentiment to be expressed simply and directly. But our love is here to stay. And so sentiment and wit become, that don't go together, become one thing. It's one of the greatest of our lyrics, and Ira, like all the great song lyricists, Berlin, Porter, Hart, had mastered the ability to do it.
And you know what? I think he was prescient. He was writing about climate change.
He was writing about, well, in that sense, he was, yeah.
The Rockies crumbling and Gibraltar's just made of clay. Well.
Yeah. Now, he didn't know that.
No, of course not.
You've picked that up. But he's making a kind of wry joke, the wit, that lets him tell this other person.
What's really had staying power is love.
Yeah. No, our love.
Not just love.
Not just love. In fact, the song was originally called Our Love is Here to Stay. And just before he sent it to the publisher, George was dead by then. He crossed out the hour.
Was that a mistake?
No, I don't think so. I think Ira, people have speculated, and I have my speculations too. I think maybe he didn't want people to figure out that it was personal. It was a little too close to the bone, too soon. Hmm. And they didn't write personally a lot. They didn't write about themselves the way people do now.
Michael's book takes a look at 1900 to 1950. City Songs and American Life is the title. It's out now. He's one of the great storytellers, and you see why we always love having him here. I want to ask you what the Michael Lasser, 50-plus years from now, really 100 years from now, is going to say about the music of 2019. How do we know? Is it part of it what has the staying power? And we can't measure that until the decades have passed and the staying power is there?
It's likely that the songs with staying power are among, will be drawn from the successful songs. Very few songs get second chances. One that did was As Time Goes By, because it got put in Casablanca. But that song was written in 32 and then was in a 42 movie. So it had died. It was gone. But there's a whole story there. But the point is it got a second chance. And that's rare in popular music, which deals in the new, the now. So it's probable that the ones that last will come from what's popular now. I don't know enough about popular music now. I mean, I spend most of my time living...
I'm more asking for the criteria of how we're going to recognize.
Survival. Do other artists, whom we may not even know now, pick it up and sing it? As musical styles change and, say, rap and hip-hop get left behind, they become moldy. Great-grandpa, do we have to listen to that old hip-hop stuff 50, 60 years from now?
I don't think that's going to happen, Michael, but go ahead.
Well, whoever thought it would happen with jazz, but jazz is very much a little niche thing
now. I'm bringing jazz back single-handedly.
No, but you understand.
I do.
It's a niche market today.
I do.
Nothing that's popular stays popular forever. I mean, one of the great controversial, you got into trouble, the waltz. But things change. So I don't know what it will be, but I do know that if singers 50 or 60 years from now want to sing it, that's a sign. Willie Nelson is singing songs from the Great American Songbook. He has two CDs. Well, no more CDs, but you understand. He sings Stardust, and he sings As Time Goes By. He sings all those great songs from the 20s and 30s. And people, young kids who never heard those songs, buy them because it's Willie.
Maybe not even realize.
It's Willie.
Yeah.
So that's one that has to last. Has to last more than one or two generations, and singers from the future have to pick it up. And when you go to a dance and you're a 16-year-old kid sitting in, they needed a trumpet player, the trumpet player got sick, and so they heard about you, they called you up. When you get there, the band leader is going to say, okay, as time goes by, Evan, you're on trumpet. Okay, you take the second eight bars. And he assumes you know it. How does he assume it? It's a standard. And if you don't know it, you'll never work again.
I love that. In our last 2 minutes, I'll close with this. Of the many songs that you write about in your book, City Songs in American Life, you've been telling us the stories this hour about how sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes the meaning is sort of the wink-wink opposite of what we're really saying. Sometimes a song like The Joint is Jumpin', this high-energy song about this fun-loving party, it's about desperate circumstances in life, poor people trying to make rent. Can you write a song setting out to make it great, or is it more the storytelling songs that capture of what's going on that last?
The songs that I care about, the Great American Songbook, these people were out to write hits, pure and simple. They were masters of craft, and they were very tough businessmen and women, very tough. They knew what the market would bear, or they thought they knew. Most of their songs flopped. Most of everybody's songs flopped. But they set out to write hits, and longevity would take care of itself.
We'll close with whatever Rob Braden thinks we should close with from that list. Whatever you want. Oh, The Joint's Jumpin'. That's so good. See what you have me to. You've got me on a Fats Waller kick, Michael Lasser. 40 seconds. What do you hope people get from this book?
The sense that New York City is at the heart of so much of American history and culture, that our music is a combination of African-American syncopation and Jewish songwriters, commercial songwriters in Tin Pan Alley. Without ex-slaves and cast-offs rejects black and Jewish, there'd be no, in New York, there'd be no such thing as an American sound.
Well, thank goodness we have this American sound, and thank you, Michael Lasser. The book available now, City Songs in American Life, 1900 to 1950, the host of Fascinating Rhythm, thrilling us with the music and the songs and the stories. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure, as always. Evan.
As always. Let's listen to a little bit of The Joint is Jumpin' and Fats Waller as we close here. Bob Volunteer, Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.
It's really jumping. Woo! Every Moses on his toes. I mean, this joint is jumping. No time for talking. It's time for walking.
Grab a jug and cut a rug. I mean, this joint is jumping.
Get your pinky.